This week, on a special Allegheny Front, we're revisiting stories that speak to important environmental issues, but also take us somewhere. We'll meet a scientist working to protect a natural resource on the prairie. Not birds, but natural sound. And on the Great Lakes, an ancient Native American squash seed is making a comeback.
They're big and they're really fat, and that's a good thing for a seed.
Plus, a look at fracking in West Virginia through poetry and how recycling gets done in Pittsburgh.
What this is trying to do is pull all the larger cardboard out, and actually all the glass and everything will fall down in between.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. Join us for environmental stories near and far on the Allegheny Front. Just take a moment and listen, really listen. What do you hear? A truck backing up? Maybe a plane flying overhead? Well, it turns out underneath all of our vrooms and beeps and rumbles, natural sound might be more important than we think. As part of the STEM Story Project distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, producer Carrie Klein has more.
Kurt Fristrup is standing in the middle of a prairie, and he's the loudest thing for miles. He and I are huddled near an empty cattle pen in Pawnee National Grassland in northern Colorado. Before he pulled out his tools, the silence here was palpable. The breeze carried no sound except the rustle of a million stalks of yellow grass. A family of pronghorn, kind of like furry antelope, padded over to us to investigate.
We have some friends.
Aren't they beautiful?
Kurt is disrupting this serene soundscape for a reason. He wants to better understand it by recording it. Cows chewed through a microphone he set up a few months ago, and he's here to install a new one.
My respect for those cattle has just gone up. They had gnawed through some of these things, and they're pretty tough.
Kurt's a senior scientist with the National Park Service in Fort Collins, Colorado. He's tasked with protecting a natural resource. It's not water or minerals or endangered species. It's sound, natural sound. His team is studying how man-made noise is drowning out the sounds of birds and insects and rain. And as more and more research links our well-being to what we hear, Kurt and his colleagues are pointing to natural sound as something to be managed and even protected.
I'd like to think that we can help everyone realize that their lives could be better and their communities could be in more vibrant places if we take some time to make them quieter.
Most of us can probably agree, our world is pretty noisy. But just how noisy is something Kurt is trying to figure out. For a decade, he and a small team of engineers, physicists, and biologists have hidden microphones in parks around the United States. Some are really remote, think grizzly bears and backcountry skiing. But others are in urban areas, like Civil War memorials and the Statue of Liberty. Each microphone recorded 24 hours a day for a month, capturing fantastic sounds, like the trumpeting of elk and goofy birds called ptarmigans. Not to mention the grunts of bears destroying the microphones. Totally worth it. But what Kurt was after was loudness. Each device measured decibel levels 33 times per second. That mountain of data fed a model that created a sound map of the contiguous United States. It took the qualities of each site, like how close it is to roads or water, and calculated median sound levels for the entire rest of the country, even places outside parks.
It looks very much like the images of the Earth at night from satellites. The brightest noise sources are concentrated in cities, and then you see these lines along the interstates and other major transportation corridors that also light up with sound.
That big picture may not be all that surprising, but the differences in noise levels are staggering.
You and I are standing about 3 feet apart, and you can comfortably hear what I'm saying. In the Sierra, the background sound level is about 1,000 times lower, which means you could stand 90 feet away from me, and I could talk at this level, and you could hear me just as clearly.
Every rise of 3 decibels doubles the sound hitting our eardrums. Now consider this. The loudest places in the U.S. are around 40 decibels noisier than the quietest. So if you do the math, Manhattan can be around 8,000 times louder than Great Sand Dunes National Park, one of the darkest spots on the map.
There are times when I've been in the field in the Intermountain West where I've not only been able to hear my own heartbeat, but I've been able to hear the heartbeat of the person in the field with me.
Our biggest noise producer? Transportation. cars, buses, motorcycles, and the hiss of tires against pavement. But even far away from roads, there are still airplanes. Kurt estimates man-made noise really took off in the mid-20th century, when flying became commonplace. Now, most of us are so used to planes, we don't even notice them. After hiking with friends, Kurt likes to ask how many they heard.
Most people will say, you know, I think I heard one or two aircraft. And being me, I've actually been counting the whole day, and I'll say, well, we actually heard 21 high-altitude jets, 10 propeller aircraft, and 2 helicopters.
So if we're not even conscious of the man-made noises around us, then what's the big deal?
So we're going to be going just from here.
Researchers at Penn State are trying to figure that out.
So you're going to begin the study by putting on a heart rate monitor that's going to continuously record your heart rate throughout the study.
That's Heather Costigan, a lab manager at Penn State. She outfitted me for a scientific experiment. It was called the Soundscape Study. The first step was stress. I had to imagine I was applying for a big job and gave a 5-minute speech in front of a one-way mirror. It was kind of intense. Then came the soundscape. Heather whisked me into a dark room. I put on headphones and settled in to watch a video. On the screen was Half Dome, the majestic centerpiece of Yosemite Valley. The sun crept across the granite. Red and yellow leaves fluttered. But when I heard a garbage truck interrupt, then a motorcycle, I cringed.
We would like to know, when is sound helpful? When is noise harmful? Under what circumstances and for what people?
Joshua Smythe is a professor of biobehavioral health at Penn State. He's Heather's boss, and he coordinated the soundscape study. His hypothesis is that natural sound will speed up stress recovery, even with people making noise in the background. But some test subjects watched that video with no man-made noise at all, and Joshua thinks they'll recover even faster. So for each test subject, he and Heather tracked heart rate and also measured cortisol, a hormone in saliva. Cortisol is a kind of stress indicator, and chronically stressed people produce a lot of it. Studies have connected that highly stressed state with all sorts of health issues. Heart problems, breathing problems, musculoskeletal problems, and a higher susceptibility to viruses and infections.
So we just generally see a decay in the capacity of the body, again, in response to these sort of chronic conditions of stress.
So when we hear irritating sounds, even if we try not to let them bother us, Joshua suspects that our stress levels still spike, priming our bodies for other health problems. But could noise ever be so bad that it alone breaks down our immune defenses? Probably not.
But if I have that and stress from work and not a particularly supportive relationship and I'm worried about money, then collectively I may be at risk.
So our cars, our airplanes, some of the very advances that make our lives easier and more productive, they might also be sabotaging us. So what's the solution? Stop driving? Renounce technology? A social scientist across campus offers a gentler perspective.
I think that talking about the positive effects of nature sounds is a much better story than talking about the negative impacts we have on the world. Both might be true, but we know that we can focus on the fact that it's important to us and it resonates with people, no pun intended.
Peter Newman leads Penn State's Department of Recreation, Park, and Tourism Management. They study why people visit parks and what they do once they're there.
Listening is a huge part of that experience that people have out there. They want to hear the noises of wildlife. They want to hear the sounds of wind and water. And those are really important things for how they feel.
In the past, studies have shown we recover better from surgery when we can see nature. Peter says we also benefit from hearing it. Research shows natural sounds can improve cognition, mood, and general well-being. And that's an idea a lot of people already buy into. It's easy to find MP3s of relaxing nature sounds. But Peter argues that we can preserve sound in the real world, too. He points to a success story in Muir Woods, a national monument outside San Francisco. In an experiment in 2009, he and a few colleagues posted signs for quiet zones and showed visitors how to be less noisy.
We actually were able to reduce the amount of noise there by about 3 decibels, which was the equivalent of doubling the people's listening area.
Conserving sound in parks may seem to be at odds with the Park Service mission of bringing people there. But back in Colorado, Kurt Fristrup sees these opposing values as a challenge. He knows the solution isn't to keep people away. Instead, he's helping develop new technology, like quieter pavement, and electric airplanes that could someday lead silent air tours. His team's also developing roadside noise gauges, kind of like the blinking signs that tell you how fast your car is moving, only it's how loud you are.
I actually look at this as an enormous opportunity to improve not only resource conditions in park, but the quality of the environments in which we all live. Because unlike many other forms of pollution, all of this goes away as soon as we throw the switch.
Throwing that switch won't be easy, but we all have an incentive to try. Because who wants a world in which recordings of nature are our only option? So next time you're outside, turn off your car, stop talking, and listen. What you hear might just be good for you. And it's free, for everyone. Natural sound is a truly infinite resource. All we have to do is not drown it out. I'm Carrie Klein.
Let's check in on a place where there's a lot of human-made racket, a sorting and recycling center in Pittsburgh. Lou Bluen took a trip there to answer a listener inquiry, part of our occasional series, Citizen Q, where we try to answer your everyday questions about the environment. This question came from someone who sometimes doubts whether her recycling efforts really make a difference.
Jenna Thompson takes her recycling pretty seriously. She's been known to pry the unrecyclable spouts from dishwashing detergent bottles. And check out her recycling bin, and those clear plastic salad tubs are stacked as neatly as a set of Russian dolls.
Well, I do nest. But you put two of those, and you don't nest those? There's no room left even in a big garbage can.
Still, despite all the care she puts into it, when it finally comes time to lug her recycling bin out to the curb, she admits sometimes a certain nagging little doubt creeps into her mind.
Is it just somehow all just going into the garbage? Because who are they paying to break apart shopping receipts from soda cans?
It is something that seems kind of mind-boggling. I mean, how do you separate all this stuff when it's jumbled up in one pile? Even the guys who work inside the industry aren't surprised people feel that way.
I guess no, because I hear it a lot.
That's the city of Pittsburgh's recycling director, Kyle Winkler.
Single stream both made life more convenient for folks, but it also, because I guess people don't understand how the technology works to sort it, there's that perception that it doesn't get sorted.
And that perception is a result, Winkler says, of the sorting process being taken out of our hands. Back in the early days of recycling during World War II, there was extreme sorting at the household level.
Somebody told me the other day that there used to be a guy that would come around and pick up rags. He was the rag man. Source-separated rag collection was a thing, which just blows my mind today.
Eventually, though, the rag man disappeared, and in his place came a dual-stream recycling culture.
So your containers, your glass, metal, plastic, was separated from your newspaper, your mixed paper, and your cardboard.
But eventually, even that was seen as unnecessary. And so we got the modern single-stream recycling system, where we don't sort anything on the household end. It all just goes into one bin, gets dumped into one truck, and then gets sorted somewhere else by somebody.
This is the very beginning of the whole process.
This is Russell Holby, and he is the somebody that oversees the sorting of Pittsburgh's recycling.
Just to give you an idea, our facility is on 8 acres. So you figure you're looking at about 50 yards of material right here, 20 feet high.
It's a mountain of recycling. And this sorting facility looks pretty much like what you'd imagine would be necessary to untangle the contents of thousands of recycling bins. There are lots of conveyor belts, lots of super heavy-duty machines.
This is an automated system that is very high-tech, but at the same time, you can't do this without manpower.
The couple dozen workers are mostly here for quality control, picking out what the machines miss. And here's basically how the whole system works. The unsorted recycling is fed in on one end, and then a series of machines pick out specific materials, one by one, until there's just one kind of material left at the very end. Cardboard, for instance, gets pulled off on the very first set of machines.
We call them star screens. So basically what this is trying to do is pull all the larger cardboard out, and actually all the glass and everything will fall down in between these stars. and hit two separate infeed belts to the next section.
The star screens, despite their name, are pretty low tech, actually. But some of this stuff is pretty amazing. The machine for separating aluminum cans, for instance, uses what's called an eddy current. It gives aluminum, which is not magnetic, a temporary charge that makes aluminum cans literally pop up in the air.
Now you can actually see how it'll throw any aluminum cans over that separator there. Everything else will fall directly down. That's pretty wild. See that?
There are other cool tricks here, too. Huge magnets pull out steel cans, and a system called Eagle Vision can actually separate three kinds of plastic at a time. It uses a camera to identify different types of plastics, and then jets of compressed air blow things right off the conveyor belt.
The first time I saw it, I was like, it's magic, but it isn't magic. It's
science.
It's science. It's physics and science.
It should be said that the system doesn't get everything. It only recovers about 90% of what comes in on the trucks. And it's kind of impossible to keep every shred of paper out of a pile of broken glass. But that's the essence of the single stream system. It's not about getting every last item. It's about percentages. It's a social contract where we tolerate a certain amount of waste to get some added convenience so that more people will recycle. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Lou Bluin.
You can find the answers to more everyday questions about the environment from our Citizen Q series, like why do we litter? And where are all of Pennsylvania's natural lakes? That's at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Usually, when you're planting seeds, you can go by the photo from a seed catalog to predict what the plant and the vegetable will eventually look like. But when you're sowing a seed with an ancient lineage that hasn't been grown for centuries?
It was just a fantastic surprise, I guess.
Later on the Allegheny Front, a squash variety gets new life among Native Americans and farmers from the Great Lakes. Next to West Virginia, where the landscape is inseparable from the longtime influence of the coal industry. Now an anthology of poems, essays, and stories released this year explores issues of fracking for oil and gas in places like West Virginia. It's called Fracture and includes the work of 50 writers from around the country. West Virginia poet Susan Truxell Sauter is one of them. I spoke with her from the studios of West Virginia Public Broadcasting about her poem. Many of the writers in the book have a personal connection to fracking. It's on their land or in their communities. What's been your experience with fracking as a resident of West Virginia?
It's so emotional for me. It hasn't happened yet to us, but I feel like I am laying on a railroad track and it's going to happen and I'm going to lose everything. But we did see a little bit about what fracking was going to do to our farm. We have 128 acres in Preston County. When this whole thing about fracking came out, all of a sudden we were seeing these like blue tanker trucks and we'd hear this like gigantic, I was like, what is going on? And then they'd come up past our house. They were fracking wells vertically. We did not know that. It was just a frightening time. It was loud. We couldn't keep our windows open. So that's my very personal connection.
The title of your poem in the anthology is The Academy Awards of Expendable. It reads like an acceptance speech. What's the concept behind the poem?
I literally was watching the Academy Awards. You know, the work that comes out on films really does move me, but the whole award ceremony, the audience, et cetera, it was just hyperbolic, you know, the baubles on the arms and the dresses and the men with all, you know, I just thought, what would an Academy Awards of West Virginia look like? There are three voices, and I start out by calling out the guilty, all of us. We took too much, you know. And so that's the first voice. And the next voice, I have the MC tell everybody to drink up their Marcellus martinis. And then West Virginia comes to the podium, and she speaks. And I think, you know, West Virginians, I think we're very confused about what we are to be proud of. We've sacrificed so much. My farm has been strip mined already. Our waters have been polluted. Our tourism industry was destroyed in Preston County. The rivers are orange. And yet we're proud, but we're kind of confused about that. So that's where that last voice of West Virginia, kind of how she approaches her thanks to everyone.
You do connect West Virginia's long history of coal mining to this current wave of fracking for natural gas. Just talk a little bit more about how you see the relationship between the two.
We have a script that we've done before. West Virginia knows how to do this. And they don't know how to do anything else. I don't think we know how to claim what is rightfully ours. A good, safe life that on land that we can go back to, that it will be there.
Who are some of the other people that are being thanked? You mentioned fur-bearing animals. Who are they?
I just pictured all these people in an audience, you know, as West Virginia is speaking to this Academy Award group. Maybe they had mink stoles on. It's all of us. And I struggle with that. I mean, it's easy to proclaim care, you know, about it, but it's harder to put our care into action. But there are consequences if we don't. And I am so angry. And I think that poem has a lot of anger in it.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit of humor as well.
Yeah, I think it's hilarious. I couldn't believe some of the stuff I was writing. I was like, oh, my gosh. And yet I don't. We're all so sensitive here in West Virginia about ourselves, you know, and it's an uncomfortable position to be putting myself in to kind of be poking fun. But I think we have to.
How does poetry address complicated, controversial subjects like fracking differently than journalism or even other arts like documentary filmmaking?
I think with poetry, you're given more license for emotion and also for the reader to maybe experience more of their own selves in the poem. I've tried polemically, you know, sit down and write a piece. I actually went and visited a wellhead and 7,000 words ensued from a piece about it. It's like a concentrated punch, poetry is. It's a good summary. It's a good kick-in-the-pants summary of where we've been.
Susan Truxell Slaughter is a writer from West Virginia. You can read her entire poem, Academy Awards of Expendable, at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel. Next week on the Allegheny Front, we're taking a look at shale gas development in our region by following the gas pipeline. From methane leaks to how we're using the ethane and gas to make our stuff.
You tell me anybody in this country that doesn't use plastics in some way and that plastics aren't critically important to their everyday lives.
And we'll talk to people whose livelihoods are being impacted by natural gas storage.
There's no other water source, so, you know, what are people supposed to do?
Join us next week for this special show. Or find the series online at AlleghenyFront.org/followthepipeline. This year, we learned about a variety of ancient squash that belonged to Native American tribes in the Great Lakes region. It's been rediscovered, and now Native Americans are sharing the seeds of the squash with each other and with small farmers. Rebecca Williams has this story.
Sarah Hoffman Graham works at Eighth Day Farm in Holland, Michigan. She invited me to a dinner party featuring a soup made from an ancient squash. Last year, the farm was given seeds of a mystery squash, They didn't know what to expect when they planted it.
I definitely didn't have a firm idea of what kind of squash it was going to grow, even what the plant was going to look like necessarily. It was just a fantastic surprise, I guess.
The seeds grew into a massive, bright orange squash. It was more than 2 feet long. The seeds of that squash passed through a couple of pairs of hands before they got to the farm. I made some calls and traced them back to Paul DeMaine. He's of Ojibwe descent and a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. He's also the editor of News from Indian Country.
The squash that's going around and seeds that are being shared now have provoked quite a bit of excitement in the native community because it is an indigenous seed.
DeMaine says his seeds originally came from the Miami tribe in Indiana. They're thought to be from a line that's somewhere between 1,000 to 2,000 years old. DeMaine says people have been sharing the seeds with each other over the past couple of years.
This seed will probably not disappear from the food market ever again, the way it's been spread, because there are now seeds that have been provided to people throughout North America.
And he says this seed sharing is happening at a crucial time.
I mean, it really is, as communities begin healing after 100 years of decline, of displacement, comes along with the revival of the language, the revival of songs and ceremonies.
One tribe in Michigan wants to make sure these seeds stay around a lot longer. The Gun Lake Band of Potawatomi keeps a seed library. It's in a small basement room in a house on tribal land.
This is our Minomin Kanin seed library.
Kevin Finney is the executive director of the GJOC Foundation. It's a nonprofit group the tribe operates. There are dozens of glass jars on wooden shelves with native varieties of corn, beans, tobacco, watermelon, and ancient squash. Finney grabs a jar off the shelf.
So these are our Gete Kosman seeds. And just to give you an idea, they're big, just like the squash. And they're big and they're really fat. And that's a good thing for a seed.
Finney says native farmers around the region can borrow seeds.
In like a library, they check out seeds and they will grow a certain variety of corn or beans or tobacco or squash. And then at the end of the year, they send us back a return on those seeds as well as keeping some.
The tribe is also reviving traditional farming methods here on 200 acres. They grow plants out here in the greenhouse. One of the tribal members introduces herself.
Anungukwe Indijnakas, Mayingan Ndodam, Machibaneshwish Potawatomi, Anishinaabe Kwe Ndao, Potawatomi Akin, and Jindaba. My name's Yabashan Oldshield. Work here at GJOC Foundation and for Gun Lake Tribe.
She says she thinks about how long the ancient squash seeds have lasted.
You know, there is spirit within those seeds, and so that's why we want to keep revitalizing and to keep building things like this, because to provide for those next seven generations, and also thinking about those ones that were in the past seven generations, that because of them, we're here. Because of them, those seeds are still here as well.
She says the work they're doing here is building what they call food sovereignty, growing their own food in traditional ways on tribal land. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Thanks for listening to this week's Allegheny Front. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. The STEM Story Project is distributed by PRX and is made possible with funds from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.